In this hour focus, we are going to begin with the definition. And the word is cyborg, C-Y-B-O-R-G. If you go to the online Oxford English Dictionary, as I did this morning, here's the definition that you get. Cyborg is a person whose physical tolerances or capabilities are extended beyond normal human limitations by a machine or other external agency that modifies the body's functioning. In other words, we're talking about an integrated man-machine system. It's a relatively recent word. The first citation here the OED comes up with is from the New York Times of 1960. And if you want to go out looking for a cyborg, generally you're going to have to go to the world of science fiction because it exists mostly in the imagination of people. However, here sitting in the studio with me this morning is a man who, for a time, seems to be the first cyborg, the first real cyborg that we know about. His name is Kevin Warwick. He's professor of cybernetics at University of Reading in the UK, where he does research on artificial intelligence and robotics. And we will talk here this morning about a couple of experiments that he did on himself, which got him quite a lot of attention and made him maybe a little, in some people's minds, a little bit controversial figure in his field. Experiments in which he had implanted chips in his body. We'll talk about that and what they did, and also where he thinks this research may very well go, because he sees some interesting possibilities for that kind of technology, everything from assisting people who are severely disabled to things that stretch the bounds of the imagination and some people might find a little bit problematic, including, for example, connecting directly with your computer without having to use keyboard or mouse, or maybe even connecting with another person. If you're interested, by the way, in reading some of his experiences and about these two experiments, he has written a book about this. It's titled I, Cyborg, and it is published by a British publisher, Gardner's UK. It is available in paper. I know I checked on Amazon this morning, so they have it, and I expect that you can find the book if you're interested in reading that story. He's here visiting the campus and is good enough to be here spending some time with us. As we talk, of course, questions are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Thank you very much for being here.
Oh, great, David. Thanks a lot.
Let's just talk about the experiments here right off so people get an idea of what it was that you did.
Yeah.
The first one, this was in 1998.
Way back in the last millennium.
Back in the last millennium. And you had this for a week. You went around with this implant. Yeah. You had implanted in your arm. Tell us what it was this thing would do.
Okay. Well, you have to remember, 1998, the people had heart pacemakers and cochlear implants to help them hear and so on. But nobody had anything at that time to give them extra abilities. And what I had was like an identification device, a bit like a dog tag type of thing. And that was implanted in my upper left arm. And when I moved around my building in Reading, my university department, what we'd got it set up to do was, as I walked through different doorways, the computer in the building knew where I was, and it knew it was me because of the implant. So it did different things. Walked towards the laboratory door, the door opened automatically. Going down the corridor, the light came on. Coming through the front door, said, "Hello, Professor Warwick." Quite a formal computer in those days. So it was really partly looking at the whole Big Brother issue, if people have these sort of things, is it a negative thing or not? But partly looking at, well, even with something like this, what can we do? And is it okay? I came out of it all right. So
now, and I guess I have a question about how it is. You could have put that in your pocket and it would...
Some people, if you go on the web, you'll see some people criticize me for what I was doing. So you could have done this with a smart card, or as you said, put it in your pocket. But, I mean, this really is what science research is about. I think you can look inside the box. A little story, if you were around, I know you weren't, but if you were around 130 years ago, Alexander Graham Bell, what he did was run a couple of wires from one room to another room, and sent a message down them to Watson, his technician, to come round the corner. And Watson heard some crackly message and came round. I'm sure he had critics that said, what did he do that for? Why didn't you just walk round the corner and tell him to come? It would have been much better, which it would have. But it was looking outside the box and doing something different. And this really was the whole concept of kind of a regular person have an implant which allows them to do different things. Yeah. That's really what it was doing.
Well, I guess the thing that I'm thinking about is how it is that this takes it, by virtue of the fact that it's implanted, that seems to take it to a different level.
And someone
might think, well, isn't you could have done that with something in your pocket,
oh, yeah,
or why
yeah,
not
yeah,
just
yeah.
put it in your pocket? But it's a whole different sort of thing when we're talking about implanting. And yet, I suppose also the question is, well, it's not really part of you. It's underneath your skin. But
I mean, these were the sort of things at the time I felt. I was part of me in the sense that it was there and with me all the time. It's not something you could leave at home. It's not something, I forgot. With a watch or glasses, you can forget them. This wasn't like that. So whenever I was walking around the department, the door opened for me. It wasn't, I could leave it behind, as it were. So it was sort of part of me, but it wasn't changing the signals that it sent out dependent on anything that I did within my, if I was feeling hot or I felt excited, the signals didn't change. It was the same signal.
Right. I did read some things where it said that you felt that it changed your relationship with the technology, or at least maybe it was the computer. You actually, I read something where you said, I actually felt a little bit closer to my computer.
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, I did because, maybe as a scientist doing the research, I was open to it. But certainly I felt I did this, the computer did that, and it opened my mind to the possibilities of, well, what's it going to be like? If I could change the signals, then what will that mean? It was a very close feeling. Yeah, what was happening was something brought about by me and the computer. Us together, mm-hmm. in a cyborg fashion, things happened because of what we were doing.
I also read that, and this is ironic because of what happened later, that your wife and your daughter thought this was kind of creepy, and your wife didn't want to get that close to that arm that had the implant.
That's right. Yeah, well, it's... You're doing something for the first time, and with the implant that I had was in a little glass tube, and glass breaks, and we weren't too sure what was going to happen. I mean, no one had had this particular type of implant before, and so she was scared that she'd roll over in normal sleep, that she'd roll over onto my arm or something.
And break it or something like that.
Break it, I'd have bits of wire and chips floating around in my body. But,
so there was some risk to you.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, well, again, there could have been some infection, but if it had broken, and it found out later on, that was quite easy to break the thing. When we were sterilizing it, like school kids, what we tried to do was boil it in water. This was before, as you do, if you're trying to sterilize something, you boil it. So we boiled it, and it just shattered. It actually exploded all over the place. So we knew there was a risk going ahead with that. What actually happened, the doctor who put the implant in, he put it in an oven at about 80 degrees centigrade, and so it didn't explode on that. All that'll have to do.
So the next experiment took it again up a few steps.
Oh, yes.
Because this first thing, as you say, basically it was a kind of an identification tag for you that you could well have been wearing on a chain around your neck, but in this particular case, it was implanted. This next experiment, this one, and it took several years of thinking about it and preparing for it, you did in 2002. This was really different because here you had an implant that was attached to a nerve.
Well, a bit more than that. I mean, 100 electrodes, 100 connections that look a bit like a hairbrush, but very, very, very small, each one of these electrodes. And literally this bunch, 100 electrodes, were fired in by neurosurgeons, and they hammered it in with a little pneumatic hammer, very, very small. It's called an impactor, which makes it sound a bit fancier than it is, but it's like a little pneumatic hammer, boom, boom, boom. And they were fired into my nervous system. Now, I wasn't quite ready for a brain implant, but although some academics probably think I should have one. But this was the main bunch of nerves. I mean, I've got now, not that the listeners can see, but you can see a scar on my left arm just near to the wrist. Right. At that point, the median nerve, this is the main bunch of nerve fibers that run down from our brain to our hand. They operate the thumb and the main fingers. Taking signals from the brain down to those fingers, the median nerve, that was where it was fired in, and you see, still see the scars from that operation now. So 100 electrodes fired into my nerve fibers.
Mm. So, and as I understand it, what this the idea was that impulses going either way, either yep. if you wiggled your fingers, that would be essentially your brain says to the hand, okay, wiggle your fingers, and it goes down that way.
Yep.
Or if we took a pin and we yep. jabbed you in the fingertip, then something would go back the other way.
Yep.
So the idea is that any of this traffic would, as in a sense, go be picked up by this implant, and then you could take that, and it would be transmitted to a computer and
yep.
stored somehow in a digital form.
Yeah, that's right. And either I was hardwired, as it were. I mean, from the implant, I had wires running a bit further up my arm. They then came out of my arm onto a little connector pad, like a socket, and we could then either by hard wire straight into the computer. So literally my neural signals, if I move my hand, the signals from my brain we could pick up, they would go straight into the computer where they could be stored digitally, yeah? Mm-hmm. Or we put an armband on which allowed the signals to be transmitted by radio to the computer. But more than that, because it was a two-way process, so as well as picking up, monitoring the signals, we could send signals from the computer down onto my nervous system, so to stimulate my nervous system. So literally, as you're saying, if with pinpricks, this is a touch sense, which we're all, the brain is and the body is wired up for. Well, we had opened up a new route, as it were, directly into the nervous system, where as long as we could figure out what signals to send in, we could send signals in, which went directly to my brain.
And did you have the experience of, for example, doing the pinprick and recording that? And then the idea was that you could play that back. Mm. If you played back that to the implant, would you then feel like your finger was being pricked, even though it was not?
Yes-ish. I mean, what we discovered was the signals on the nervous system are an awful lot more complex than I think anybody imagines. There are various theories that say these bunch of nerve fibers deal with signals going this way, the motor signals from the brain to the fingers. These bunch of nerve fibers, it wasn't like that at all. It's much more complicated. So to an extent, we could achieve that. Yes, we could pick up the signals and we could get clearly the signal waveforms. And if we then sent in something near to that, we could simulate, yeah, as though this is what I would have felt if this finger was being touched. That's what it was, a similar thing, but we not to the extent that we could pick out, right, this signal means that it's my index finger being touched, this signal means that it's my thumb being touched. We didn't have that. It was really, we were stuck. We could send a few signals in and it felt like a tickling on my index finger.
Yeah. Well, for those people who would ask the question, well, why would you want to do this in the first place? Let's talk about about how one might apply that, because I do know that in fact, in part, one of the interests is this idea that if you have a situation where a person has been injured and the signals from the brain to the legs, for example, aren't going,
yeah. Yeah.
Theoretically, if you could figure out exactly how to do it, you could put these kind of implants into the leg, I suppose. And again, if you knew what information to give, if you knew exactly how to do it, you could then supply that missing information that previously had gone from the brain to the legs and make it possible for
I think there's two. Yeah, I mean, it's a good someone who's had a spinal injury. Christopher Reeve would be the one I think most people know. Yeah, the signals from his brain. He's an intelligent guy. He can think about moving his hands and legs and so on. But as I would see it, there's a break in his nervous system, and the signals don't get to where they're supposed to go to. So there's two possibilities there. One is to pick up the signals where we can. This would be a direct brain implant with the same implant we could use as the one we use, but rather in the nervous system in the brain. And so when he thinks about moving his fingers, yeah, one possibility is to pick up the signals where we can and then perhaps play them down, lower down, and hopefully bring about some movement. The other alternative is to pick those signals up and misuse them to do something else with them. So that, for example, if he thinks about moving his fingers, we use the same signals to drive his car forwards or to make the coffee or to switch the lights on. So although he initially thinks about moving his right index finger, that signal, when it's picked up by the implant, can be used to switch the light on. So there's the two things. One is to try and bring about some movement. The other is to use the signals that would allow that person to do things that they couldn't ordinarily do.
Yeah. Given the fact that even the what would be required for a simple physical action, that you are talking about a pretty complex system involving a lot of parts, how reasonable, how many technical hurdles, what do you have to get over so that you could actually do this in practice?
Yeah, I think bringing about some movement, there's a long, long way to go before we fully understand how the signals are operate, how the brain is sending the signals and so on. But I don't see that as being the main problem. I think if we could look at rewiring, so to put a couple of implants in across the break, that I would believe that a person could then relearn, as it were, what signals to send in order to bring about some movement. So literally you're rewiring part of the nervous system, so the brain will have to learn perhaps to send different signals than it did originally. Mm-hmm. But that the brain is a very adaptable, it's a very plastic thing, and that if it gets some good feedback, that suddenly you can start to move your thumb a little bit, whereas you couldn't, it will learn relatively rapidly what signals to send in order to make that happen even more, given the new wiring that you've now given the brain. So, but we don't know that yet, because as far as I'm aware, nobody's tried anything like that.
Well, I would imagine there would be people who actually would be willing to serve as experimental subjects for that.
But so, then you're into ethical considerations and having to get approval, which for the experiments that we did, we had to get full ethical approval for everything we did.
Though you were doing it on yourself.
Oh, yes. Oh, especially. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But the surgeon wanted to do it and I wanted to do it. So it perhaps wasn't as difficult if we were taking 10 subjects who, you know, weren't part of the experiment and they're sort of gullible people, as it were. Then you have to get more ethical clearance. So maybe it was a little bit easier, but we still had to go through the appropriate procedures.
Well, is anybody, as far as you know, anybody thinking about actually trying to take this a few steps further?
Oh, yeah. I think there are a number of groups in the US who are looking to use this type of implant for people with disabilities to do what we've been talking about. As far as I'm aware, there's a number of things. One is it's just a single direction. My implant was two ways. We could send signals in, and hence there were all sorts of extra things that we haven't talked about yet. And as far as I'm aware, nobody is planning to do this type of experiment on a regular person, sorry to use that expression, or to use a bi-directional. As far as I'm aware, they're just looking for a monitoring exercise rather than putting. So I think we already have gone quite a bit further, but the brain implant will be the next one for us.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that I mentioned a little bit ago, I talked about the reaction of your wife to the first implant.
Yes.
And I said that it was kind of ironic because of what happened later, what happened was she agreed also to have this second kind of implant that we were talking about, the same one done, which raised some interesting possibilities about, what happens when you hook two of these things together?
Yeah, well, I have a bit of a communications background. I used to work with British Telecom, and hence the possibility of linking the two together in different people was, for me, tremendously exciting. And, she's a bit of a nagging wife, and she knew that this was exciting, but she wanted to be part of it. What she had were electrodes pushed into her nervous system from the outside, which, as you can imagine, is very, very painful. And we thought she was going to get some anaesthetic for this so that it wasn't painful. But in fact, that didn't happen. The doctor said he needed to know when he had a good connection. So literally, she had to lie there while the doctor pushed electrodes into her nervous system. Very painful. But cut a long story short, what we did was send signals directly from one nervous system to the other. So how we did it was, if I moved my hand, the signals from my nervous system, my neural signals, went via the computer down onto her nervous system and back the other way from her to me. So it was a sort of not telephony from brain to brain or nervous system to nervous system, but a bit like a telegraph connection from one nervous system to another. Mm-hmm. And sort of a dot-dot-dash type of communication. We did it for the first time, nervous system to nervous system, but clearly now it's there. If we put implants in two people's brains, then it's looking at the basis of thought communication.
Yeah. Well, I want to go to that in a minute.
But, I thought you would.
What I know, one of the things that you did was, when you had this implant in your hand, you could take the impulses from that, and by moving your hand a certain way and sending that information to a robotic arm, you could get it to mimic the movement?
Oh, yeah, and twofold. I mean, not only that, with the robotic arm that you're talking about, it had fingertip sensors on it. So when the robotic hand gripped an object, then signals from the fingertip sensors could be sent back down onto my nervous system. So with a blindfold on, I could feel how much force the robot hand was applying to an object. And we actually did that. I came to Columbia University in New York, and we linked up via the internet back to the UK. So you can imagine, I'm in the lab in New York. I move my hand, the signals from my brain, the neural signals, are sent by the internet to the robot hand in the UK, which then operates. The fingertip sensors on the robot hand in the UK press onto an object, and signals are sent back across the internet, played down onto my nervous system in New York. And I was able, quite accurately, to just apply enough force by moving my hand, which moved the robot hand, so the robot hand just gripped an object. So I was actually feeling how much force the robot hand was applying on a different continent.
When you were doing this with you and your wife, mm-hmm. Can you do that same thing? Can you move your hand and have that information sent to her implant? And what happens? Does her hand move?
I think this is something that will be possible in the future. I mean, because it depends where the hand is positioned. It could be, you do all sorts of things. I think that will take a bit more. I mean, literally what we were at, if I moved my hand, she could feel the pulses that were moving, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So we would need a lot more connections and need to learn, for both of us to learn about the signals and so on. I would have to say it would be possible to do that, but downstream, not this week, as it were.
We're about midway through here, and I should introduce again our guest, Kevin Warwick. He's professor of cybernetics at University of Reading in the UK and does work on artificial intelligence and robotics. As he mentioned, he worked for a number of years for British Telecom. Then he went and took a degree at Ashton University, followed by a PhD and research post at Imperial College London. And then after that, held positions at Oxford, Newcastle, and Warwick universities before he went to Reading, and has written many papers on dealing with these subjects, many technical papers. If you're interested in reading a book that's for a general audience about this experience and these experiments, the book is titled I, Cyborg. It is in paper now. It's published by Gardeners UK. He's here visiting in Champaign-Urbana and was good enough to come and talk with us. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. Now, Let's talk about the brain implant, because here this is an area that gives people some free range for their imagination to imagine, depending on how they feel about this thing, either good or bad.
Yep.
The idea that you could plant a similar kind of implant in the in an individual's brain, and then do what?
Well, the communication side of things is one thing we've already mentioned a little bit. I mean, if we're looking at two people's brains, not one, then we can look at sending signals directly from one brain to the other. Mm-hmm. And that raises all sorts of questions as to speech. How important is speech as a means of communication? Can we improve on it? Can we send signals, if you're thinking about an ice cream, let's say, you can send those signals directly. You don't have to mention the words ice cream. You can send the signals directly to another person in a way that they could understand. But then you're opening up possibilities of memory signals, changing somebody's memories and thoughts by putting signals into the brain. So you're looking at, it's almost a matrix, a science fiction scenario, but this is actually carrying it out. One other thing which relates to what we've already done is looking at increasing the range of senses that a human has. Five senses, and our vision, our sight is perhaps the best of those. But there's a lot of things going on in the world we just don't get to sense. Infrared signals, ultrasonic signals, ultraviolet signals. These are not unimportant signals, but we just don't sense them as humans. But if we can push signals directly onto the nervous system or directly into the brain, then it opens up the possibilities of sensing the world in a much richer way. We can understand what's going on around us in a much more complex way.
Hmm. And you also introduced the possibility of taking the human-machine interface to a different level. Again, the idea would be that with the appropriate kind of implant that you could, for example, you could communicate with your computer without having to resort to keyboard or mouse.
Quite easily, yes. I think when you look at what we're doing when we communicate in that way, our brains are electrochemical, quite complex signals. We then convert those to very simple mechanical signals. Either now I'm converting them to speech, these very simple coded messages. Or if I type into a keyboard, the mechanical signals are movement of my fingers to press the keys and so on. Well, why do that if we can send the signals directly from the brain into the computer in order to communicate, or, and back the other way? It will save a lot of time, should be much more accurate, and maybe our bit rate that we can send signals out and receive signals will increase dramatically. We'd have to learn how to do it, of course. I'm not sure here's the implant, I can do it for you this afternoon. That's not saying that. We've got a lot of things to learn, as is the case with anything that's new to you. And there may be pitfalls there, but it seems a tremendously exciting avenue of research to find out practically what can we achieve.
There are a whole raft of really interesting questions raised by this idea. And, you know, one set of questions, and probably a lot of them would be beyond me, would be the technical questions. That is, would be the technical questions that come under the heading of, if you decided you wanted to do that, how exactly do you do that?
Yeah.
And there's an awful lot of things we would have to learn, obviously,
That's right.
to be able to do that.
Yeah.
Then there are the other side of the question that are those questions that let us assume that we've solved all those problems.
Mm-hmm.
Let us look at the implications of such a thing for human beings, for the way they relate to one another, for the way they think of themselves, for the way we think about consciousness, and all of that. You know, just imagine how it is that would change us, and how we relate, and how we relate to the world if we could do that. And there seems there to be a very big question about whether we could actually handle it.
Yeah, I mean, ethical questions, but also philosophical questions, I think.
Yeah.
I mean, some of them, like looking at feeding in an extra sense, an ultrasonic sense, which is something I've experienced from my nervous system. Now, it's something, say, an ultrasonic sense, a bit like a bat senses the world. is good for somebody who is blind. Let's give them an ultrasonic sense, not to repair the blindness, give them a different sense and allow them, if they want it, to move around and detect objects and so on. And I think ethically, most of us would feel, oh, that's a good thing to do if the person wants it and we've got the technology. But then you look on the other hand and you say, well, is it good for somebody who isn't blind, somebody who it's increasing their range? Is that right? Is it right to upgrade humans, to give them other abilities technically, which is something we've done, you know, by flying or by wearing glasses or by we've done that externally. Even computers do that in terms of memories. They give us external memories that we didn't have before. So we upgrade externally. This is looking at doing it much more internally. And yes, it raises the questions, how much can the brain take? Will it completely change us? If suddenly we have not the computer external to us, but the computer as linked directly to us. Your brain is no longer an individual entity, but your brain is partly what you've got now and partly a computer brain. How much will that change you? Will your morals, your values, I believe, they would change completely. That if you were effectively part human, part machine, how much would you value humans anymore? Well, and remembering now, the humans are as humans as we know them, but you now have extra senses, you have much better memory, you can communicate just by thinking to another individual. Maybe you can think in many more dimensions. In any definitions of intelligence, you are super intelligent. Why would you want to communicate with these silly little humans that are just in the you know, they're, it's almost like now as humans we... Well, do we treat cows and dogs as being as intelligent as us? Well, no, we don't, obviously. We wouldn't go around and do what a cow tells us to do because it's intellectually, it's not really on the same level. Mm-hmm. And so here you're looking, if you had this connection as a cyborg, would you listen to what humans were telling you? Well, why should you? They're pretty stupid in comparison.
We have a couple of callers. Let's talk with them. If you put on the headphones, 333-9455 in Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here, we have a caller here in locally in Champaign-Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that both iCyborg and Kevin Warwick's other book, March of the Machines, are actually being published by the University of Illinois Press in paperback, and they're due out in August.
I suspected that there was a connection with U of I Press, but I was not informed, so I really appreciate you.
Yeah.
I'm sure someone probably know. It wasn't transferred to my data banks.
Okay, great. Well, we just thought we would get the word out.
Okay. So that's iCyborg and March of the Machines. Mm-hmm. They're both going to be published in paper by U of I Press. And,
yes.
And when...
They should be out in August.
Okay, August. Very good. Because I know that, as I mentioned, the one book is this UK publisher has done it, and I assume it's available in the United States.
It'd be a much better version that's coming out. I mean, I'm not sure how official it is in the United States via the route that you're talking. Whereas so it might be almost illegal. So the University of Illinois Press.
Oh, not illegal. It's out in our catalog.
But the University of Illinois Press, it will be perfectly legitimate and legal.
Yeah.
And people can order it now, I presume.
Oh, definitely.
There we go.
That's right.
They just won't get to get delivery for a little bit.
And with every copy, a free microchip.
That would be fun, wouldn't it?
If they volunteer.
Okay. Right.
Thank you for the call. Very good. Let's go to Lafayette and line number two.
Yeah,
hello.
I might have missed part of the show and discussion, but I'm just wondering how these electrical signals will be interworking with biological cells in the brain or the production of neurotransmitters and how that might affect mood or relaxation or, you know, just the main, you know, if you have an overload, you know, how that might affect the brain or consciousness or mood or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, these are all important questions. All we've done from the study so far, part of it was to look at how the body reacted to the implant. Now, it was in my arm for just over 3 months. So what we could see was whether there was any attempt to reject it, which there wasn't, far from it. In fact, both physically and mentally, all the indications were that my body accepted the implant from our study. In fact, when the surgeons came to take it out, they had a job to get it out. The body effectively, body tissues had grown round the implant, were pulling it into position. And other people's research indicates that that seems to be, if the body decides it's going to accept it, and that's both a mental and a physical acceptance, that's what tends to happen. But the point you raise about moods and is a positive and a negative. There may well be effects that we've got to learn about that could affect a mood negatively. But there's also lots of positive possibilities that if you can affect a mood by injecting electrical signals into the brain, then can you you're feeling a bit down, well, inject some signals and you feel relaxed. It's sort of rather than taking chemical drugs as we do now to look at what would be e-medicine, electronic medicine, to give yourself perhaps different effects, even better ones, without maybe the side effects. I mean, certainly with things like Parkinson's disease, that now that some people have been successfully treated with electrodes into the brain to overcome the shaky feeling. So, I mean, if you can do that, then what other possibilities are there? So I think what you said is very important, but there's positive and negative aspects to it.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks.
All right, to Urbana, the next caller, line three. Hello.
Yeah, I have a comment and a question. The comment is you might want to check out today's New York Times, which is available on the web, and they mentioned that there's an article entitled "With Tiny Brain Implants, Just Thinking May Make It So," and it mentions that in 1996, Dr. Philip Kennedy in Atlanta implanted electrodes into severely disabled people, and at least one could type up to three words a minute, just by thinking, apparently. But I have a question. I was wondering if in England they consider that the Turing test has been passed or not, because I understood that, or at least I clipped out an article from the Daily Telegraph, and in 2000, that said, I believe it was, and it said that there had been a test and that 30% of people being tested against, I think they call them a chat bot, had actually thought that they were dealing with a human being, and apparently, and according to this article at least, Turing only required 30% of the people, or, you know, he predicted that it would be something like 30% at the end of the 20th century would confuse a computer and a human being. And I was just wondering if you knew if that's
yeah.
a general thing.
Well, quite different points. I mean, firstly, yeah, Philip Kennedy's work with stroke victims, a couple of stroke victims, monitoring signals. So this is a unidirectional implants that he used, and very, very successfully. I admire his work greatly, picking up signals from the brain and using those to move a cursor around on a computer screen. I think the article you refer to today is looking at doing something very similar. Again, as I understand it, it's unidirectional, so it's not looking at injecting current, which is something we have done. But again, it is with people who have disabilities. So it's looking at doing what Philip has already done, but with more electrodes. But part of our research, my research, is looking at implants for everybody, practically. So we've already been doing implants for myself, not for getting over problem areas, but to enhance abilities. As for the Turing test, I was in, every year they have what's called the Loebner Prize, which is a mini version of the Turing test, where they have a bunch of machines and they compete with a couple of humans, and a group of experts have to enter different points into a computer, and from the responses they get, decide which are the humans and which are the computer. And I was one of five people who were entering signals. Two of the five, this was back in 2001, two of the five were fooled into believing that one of the machines was more human than either of the two humans that were responding. So that I make it as 40%. I think if ever, realistically, if ever a machine could, in the full range, both in terms of words, signals, and in terms of appearance and everything, if ever a machine could fool us, any human, completely, into not knowing whether it's a machine or a human, then it will be machines that are making all the decisions on Earth. They'll be far, far more intelligent than we are, because we can't fool machines that way. So,
but do you know if that fulfilled the Turing prediction or not? Or?
Well, I think the full Turing prediction was this. It wasn't just a communication. It was the whole skamoodle. You know, it was the whole, you can't, there's something in, like, I'm sitting, David's here next to me, and if he turned out to be a robot, then that would have fulfilled it. So, but the mini version of the Turing test, which has become this entering signals into a computer and something, a computer fooling you in terms of its communication, and you don't know, I think, yeah, I mean, I would agree. I think it should be more than 30%. As soon as you say you've got to fool all the experts in the world, well, there's going to be somebody that picks it up as you would whatever. So it depends how you want to define it, I think. To me, it's, I don't know how relevant it is anyway. It's an interesting exercise, though.
Okay, thanks.
All right, thank you. About 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Kevin Warwick. He's professor of cybernetics at University of Reading in the UK, where he does research on robotics and artificial intelligence. Questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I'm interested in having you talk a little bit about, you know, the things that we've been talking about and the possibilities when you stretch the thing to the limits of the imagination, with the kinds of brain implants that we've been talking about. It makes me think about how it is we think about evolution, mm-hmm. and the idea that most people, as they think about evolution, what it is, that it has something to do with an organism's response to the environment and changes in the environment that are basically beyond the control of the organism. It's something that happens, then the organism responds. Well, here we're talking about the ability of or the possibility of technology, which is the creation of humans, mm-hmm. to essentially do something in along the evolutionary line.
I think you're right. It is a designer evolution. I mean, this will, a lot of geneticists might disagree here, because you're talking about something which, okay, if I upgrade my abilities technically, so my brain then starts to, let's just take in an extra sense, that's what I'm doing with it, and my wife has the same implant, she takes in an extra sense, and so on. So our bodies, our brains tune into that. The question then becomes one, if we have children, will they be born with their brains ready to receive this implant, so that literally it is, as a whole species has been formed? I think there are large schools of thoughts among geneticists that would not be the case. Mm. So that the habits of the parents then become part of a genetic trend. I mean, I don't know that I agree with that. I think that if your brain and your whole body twists, changes so that it can take in extra senses or communicate in a new way, I feel that it wouldn't take too long before genetically that appears. And therefore, maybe I'm now going to get loads of geneticists saying, what rubbish is he talking? but it is design. I mean, in a way, humans have done that anyway. We can't normally fly, but like most people now fly around the world and so on. Mm-hmm. And maybe our bodies and our brains have changed to an extent because that we think in different ways and we act in different ways because of that. This is looking at taking that internal step. So literally we're changing the body within, and whether that would have a knock-on effect to children and children's children. And so it again raises all sorts of questions.
You're also interested, I believe, in artificial intelligence.
Oh, yeah.
This, again, it takes us into a slightly different but connected direction, where we're talking about essentially, can we get machines that can think the way we do? Not just, we have now machines that are very powerful number crunchers, but the question
is,
you know.
Well, I think this is I maybe look on it a different way. I think some people do like the Turing test was one of the people that phoned in just then, is trying to get a machine to think like a human thinks and to say, well, it's only an intelligent thought if a human would have them. We can see a machine must have those sort of thoughts to be intelligent in any way. I tend to look the other way. The way a computer thinks is different to how a human thinks, as possibly the way a cow thinks and the way a bat thinks. They're all somewhat different to how a human thinks. And a machine's intelligence can be quite different to a human intelligence. As you said, number crunching is a big advantage of machine intelligence, I would say. It can do things we can't. The memory capabilities, again, big advantage of machine intelligence. So I look at it the other way, and my cyborg studies have really been saying, well, okay, the big advantage of machine intelligence, how can we actually make that for the best for us? How can we upgrade humans to take on that so it's not external, but it's actually part of us? Why not have some of that memory capability? Mm. You know, if you could link your brain directly to the internet, I know there's a program, Super Millionaire and Who Wants to Be a Millionaire. Well, if you could, then you'd get asked a question, who was the 16th president?
You'd know right away.
Straight away. No. Yeah. So one big advantage is you'd win Super Millionaire every time.
Of course, well, that's true. But if everybody had that implant, then we'd have to design another contest
because
everybody would have the answer.
Yeah.
Do you think, though, that it is possible at some point we will build a machine then, though, that not only has machine intelligence, but it also has human intelligence?
Well, certainly we will. I can see the way we're going. As humans, we will build machines that have an intellectual capability that we probably can't handle if we don't join with them. So there is, and that my one book, March of the Machines, is about that, where we're going and what the realities of it are. Certainly in terms of some aspects of human intelligence, people are trying to do that. But to get a complete copy that would have the same human intelligence in all its ways, I would think would require a biological material that was identical to the human brain living in a biological body that was identical to the human body. And maybe then extra thing, you'd really be having to create artificially, literally, a human brain, which we know the quicker way, sex is perhaps a much more exciting way of doing that. I don't know why would we want to do that? It's a big question. So it's difficult to see us having here's a human brain that is actually a robot, but that it can have more capabilities because it has a machine brain. I think it can be difficult. I know there was the Spielberg film was really trying to take a machine, a robot, and get it to be a human, but it was forgetting all these extras that there were, the extra sense that the robot could have, but it somehow didn't seem to have. It didn't have the mathematical abilities that you talked about, or the memory. It was trying to sort of restrict it to having human emotions and human behaviors.
Right now, the machines need us as Premier as much as we need them. But of course, there a lot of people have imagined dystopias where the machines don't need us anymore.
Yeah.
Those kinds of things, and there are plenty of them: Matrix and Terminator and things
that. Yeah,
you know, people have imagined these conditions when the machines take over. Is that something actually worth worrying about?
Oh, I think definitely, yeah. I think particularly in the military domain, we can see the development of machines that do make their own decisions. And if we ever switch the switch, so an automatic defense system is looking after itself and can do harm to humans, then I think we're getting into a very dangerous area where Terminator, Matrix become distinct facts rather than potential futures. Mm.
Well, that I'm sure there are plenty of examples that we could find of technologies that got away from us.
Mm.
We do have this, I think, as humans, we have a bit of a technology to tendency with the technology to say, isn't that exciting? Gee whiz, let's do it. And then later think about...
It's part of being a human. It's part of being human, yeah.
Well, yeah. So I guess that then that's the question when we're talking about this particular kind of technology. Is it any more likely that we're going to keep that sort of under...
I don't think so. I think it's just about a certainty. I mean, there may people think, well, yes, but you can always switch the computer off. You can... But even now, you can't. Can you switch the internet off, which is really what we're talking about? No. Theoretically, yes. But practically, of course not. We're so dependent on the technology in that case that we cannot switch it off in a realistic sense.
Hmm. We probably, between us, got about another 40, 50 years to go. What do you think we're likely to see along these lines in our lifetime?
Oh, I mean, for me, within a decade, I want to be part of a thought communication experiment.
So you're ready for the brain implant?
Oh, yeah. Well, I will be ready. I think we've got a little bit to learn. But no, I want to be part. The things that Graham Bell did many years ago excite me so much, and I would love to be part of that first couple of people that think to each other for the first mm-hmm. time.
That it's both fascinating and troubling, I guess. I think about all those unsolicited telephone calls. If someone finds a way to tap into that, we're in big trouble.
Oh yeah.
We're
going
to be getting spam on our implants.
Hacking in viruses that start off as a software virus and become a biological virus, I think.
Well, it's not, if we imagine brain implants, that then it's not much of a leap to imagining all of those.
And certainly the memory aspects are incredible. Not only positive, mm-hmm. helping people who have psychological problems, but having memories downloaded that you've never actually had, somebody else's memory downloaded into your brain, all those things, which are exciting but frightening. It's mm-hmm. a brave new world.
Well, at that, I think we'll finish up. If you're interested in, as we said, reading about some of these ideas, some of the experiments that our guest, Kevin Warwick, was involved in, and some of his thinking along these lines, there are two books that you can look for, iCyborg, which describes the experiments that we talked about, and March of the Machines. And both of these books will be published by the University of Illinois Press this summer, should be available in August, so you can look for those.
Order them now.
All right. Kevin Warwick, he's professor of cybernetics at University of Reading in the UK. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers.